I'm a sick and twisted individual. I love those things when they happen. If I have an emergency and I make it, I'm jazzed because I practice for this. I plan for it. That's why I'm there. I mean, anybody can fly a plane on a beautiful sunny day. You know, it doesn't take anybody with any special skill to do that. It takes a really good pilot to come through when the chips are down.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Repeat on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello and welcome back to the show. This week, we are sticking with the aviation theme. Like many of us, Kerry McCauley had a fascination with planes growing up, but unlike most of us, he decided to carry that passion forward into his professional life and take it to an absolute extreme. Kerry has spent over 30 years as a ferry pilot, which is one of the most niche and extreme jobs you can have as a pilot. Basically, it's his job to fly small planes, distances, and over routes that just about no other pilots are willing to. Basically, when someone sells a plane or, say, has a plane in Europe that they want to spend some time flying in the United States, but it's too small a plane to fly across the Atlantic Ocean, they call Kerry because Kerry is willing to make that flight. As you'd expect, when you do this sort of work over the course of 30 plus years, you pick up quite a few adventure stories. Flying by flashlight, losing engines, even robbing a bank in Spain. Kerry is just no shortage of thrills. And so I really enjoyed this really impressive conversation with someone that's about as good as it gets at what they do, which is the sort of folks we're most interested in. Speaking of, this episode, per usual, is brought to you by Zwift, our presenting partner. And I'm really excited about our new partnership. If you listened to the show last week, you'll be familiar with this. If not, I'm going to touch on it again. We have a really exciting series of group rides that I'm hosting on Zwift, where we are releasing new episodes of the podcast early, pre-releases that play during these group rides. So as an example, November 27th, we kick off this series with Evie Richards of Trek Factory Racing. And the episode, which I recorded with Evie not too long ago, will premiere during that group ride. So if you join Evie and I, Evie will also be on the group ride. She'll be co-leading it with me. If you join us on that Zwift group ride on November 27th, you'll get a first exclusive listen of our podcast together. Even cooler, you'll be able to use the Zwift companion app to ask us questions real time as you're listening to the episode, follow-up questions. Like I said, there will be a whole series of these group rides. It kicks off November 27th with Evie Richards. And then on December 4th, we'll be joined by Hattie Harnden, a real rising star of the mountain bike world, U21 Enduro World Series champion, and an absolute hitter on the cross-country bike, and an absolute hitter on the cyclocross bike. She's UK elite cyclocross national champion and only 18 years old. And the group rides and the guests just keep coming thick and fast. Also on the list, Stefan Tempier, Yolanda Neff, Ellen Noble. Anton Cooper is a tentative addition for later in February. So stay tuned. We'll be announcing those dates more as these shows roll on. And lastly, as an added fun perk, the Trek Super Caliber will be an in-game option to ride. That bike isn't typically available on Zwift, but when you join us on these group rides, you can choose to ride the Trek Super Caliber, which is super fun. It's a really wicked looking replica of the real life version. And speaking of replicas of real life versions, there's an official jersey produced by Valet associated with this group ride. So if you finish one of these group rides with us, you'll unlock the official Adventure Stash times Zwift jersey. I'm really proud of how it turned out. I think it's a pretty cool design. And you'll be able to wear that jersey in perpetuity as you continue your riding in Zwift, if you like. And if you'd like a real life version, those will also be for sale, lovingly produced by Volley, in the near future. And if you complete one of our group rides, you'll get a discount on those jerseys too. So stay tuned. November 27th, you can go to Zwift to register for these group rides. I'll post a link on my social media as well. And we hope to see you there. This episode is also brought to you by Zip. Zip just recently, November 17th, just released an incredible, aesthetically beautiful refresh of all of their stuff. As you may have seen with a lot of their new wheel releases, they have a completely new look. It just screams fast, which is spot on for the brand because their parts are screaming fast. I've loved riding Zip the last year. I can't wait to keep rolling with them next year. But you should go check out their all new aesthetic with their new handlebars, their stem, their seat posts. It looks so good with their new wheels. Some of y'all may have caught some photos of my Trek checkpoint with these new graphics, these updated cockpit pieces, and it's just a gorgeous upgrade to what already was one of my favorite bikes. Zip also released a really cool new Quick View integrated mount that is a bike computer mount, light mount, and GoPro mount all in one that is integrated in part of a stem faceplate. It's this crazy, clean looking, really nicely engineered mount for all of y'all that love your gadgets on your bike. I'm certainly one of those folks. Go check out Zip's all new aesthetic release here. Thank you, Zip, so much for making all of us faster, supporting the Adventure Stash podcast, and doing what you do. Thank you all for listening.
How's your day going?
Pretty good. Spent the morning hunting with my dad, and we'll do this, and I'll go back out into the woods.
Yeah, nice. How was it this morning? Did you see anything, get anything?
Yeah. No, I didn't shoot anything. I shot a big one bow hunting, so I'm in super trophy mode right now and just kind of spending time with my dad, helping him get one. We saw a couple. He hasn't got a shot yet, but it was beautiful. It's snowing out there. I just love being in the woods in the morning when it's snowing, so real cool.
Yeah, and you're in Wisconsin?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. First of all, I'm kind of curious, are you flying much right now? I mean, during these holiday months, during deer season, all that sort of thing, do you just take jobs as they come? What's your relationship with flying at the moment, or especially in light of the pandemic, if that's impacting things at all for you?
Right. Well, my two main flying jobs, well, three main flying jobs are, number one, flying skydivers, which actually I don't do a whole lot anymore. Mostly I jump. I'm the chief pilot at our school, but I let the other guys do most of the work, but that's done for the season. I also fly corporate jets, but since the COVID hit, I've been pretty slow on that. I haven't done much of that, which has been fine. I've, you know, had a busy skydiving season, and now it's hunting season, so I don't care. And as far as ferry flying goes, I only really take the trips I really want to take these days. Like if it's a really cool plane I really want to fly, or if it's going someplace really amazing that I'd love to go to. Other than that, I don't do a whole lot of it anymore. I'm supposed to be picking up a small twin in Norway here in a couple of weeks and taking it to Florida. So that'll be fun. But
yeah. When you say corporate, are you talking like charter private jet type stuff? Not commercial, I assume.
Yeah, charter private jets.
Cool. So let's define what a ferry pilot is. Your stories are, from what I've heard so far, incredibly unique. And you've lived a really awesome life that is worthy of a book. And you have a new book out called Ferry Pilot, new-ish. And so for those that don't know, if you would, define for us what a ferry pilot does.
Okay, well, a ferry pilot is a pilot who delivers airplanes all over the world. Like if somebody buys an airplane that's in Ohio and they live in Singapore, they need to find somebody stupid enough to fly it over the ocean. That's where I come in. most pilots aren't, they don't have the knowledge to fly small planes over the ocean and around the world. and it's relatively dangerous, and it takes a pilot with specialized skills and small brains to take those kind of risks and make those flights. And that's what I do. So I've been doing it for about 30 years now.
Yeah. I guess I'd like to dig into, you know, the logistics of how a job like that works. So let's use this one in Norway, for example, as a case study. You said you have in a couple of weeks. Are you flying commercially over to Norway to begin with and then flying it back? Okay. And so when you take us through, you know, A to Z, the process here, how does someone that needs a plane moved get in touch with you? And then at this point in your career, how do you decide, yes, I'm interested in this, or no, it's not worth my time? All the way through, you know, getting to the plane, what do you do in terms of checking it? What do you look for? All that sort of thing.
Okay, well, the way somebody finds me these days is usually by word of mouth. Over the years, I've worked for a couple different ferry companies that people would contact them, and that company, I was one of their pilots. These days, I don't work for a specific company. I'm kind of have my own company. And the guy that wants me to fly this plane from Norway, I actually helped deliver a plane to him down in Argentina, actually, a few years ago. So he liked what I did then. I got the plane there safely, so he got in contact with me. And what I do is, from start to finish, basically, I look at the route and I look at the plane, first of all, determine, can it be done? I mean, there's sometimes some planes, they need to be disassembled, put in a container, and put on a ship because it's just way too small. But that's usually relatively expensive, time consuming, and tough to do on a lot of planes, because when you take the wings off an airplane and you put it in a container, it's sometimes really hard to put back together again. You know, you get somebody in some other foreign country that gets this airplane kit and they can't get it back together quite right, and you've destroyed an airplane. So if I deem it worthy to fly over the ocean, take a look at the route, where it needs to go. Over the Atlantic, for example, there's two basic routes. You can go the northern route, which is Canada, Greenland, Iceland, Europe, or the southern route, where you go from Canada down to the Azores, which are a group of islands off the coast of Portugal. And then from the Azores, you can go to Africa, the Middle East, or Europe. So the northern route, you can do it without ferry tanks. The southern route, you definitely need ferry tanks, because that's about 1,500 miles open ocean. And ferry tanks are, you know, metal fuel tanks that you put inside the plane, fill them with gasoline, and they're plumbed into the airplane's fuel system. So it gives you the extra range to go 1,500 or 2,000 miles, so you don't run out of gas.
Yeah. And so, say you're taking that northern route, you're stopping in Greenland to refuel. Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah, most of the time. You can, if you have a plane that has the range, you can go straight from Iceland to Canada. But most of the time, we'll stop in Greenland, which I really like to do, because I love flying into Greenland. Greenland is one of the prettiest places in the world to fly in, especially the southern tip of Greenland. The ice cap is oozing off the southern tip there, down into all these fjords. There's millions of icebergs, and it's gorgeous when the weather's nice. When the weather's bad, it's one of the most dangerous airports in the world to fly into. So
yeah.
It's one or the other.
Yeah. Speaking of dangerous airports, a couple of friends and I were looking at some details about the Telluride airport recently, because I live just 2 hours from Telluride, and that's a pretty famous airstrip. I don't know if you've flown in there before or can picture it, but it's sort of on this. Are you familiar with it?
Yep, I know it.
Have you landed there before?
Yep, I've been there.
Yeah. Does that make your list in terms of dicey places to land, or is it not as crazy as it looks to the untrained eye?
Oh, no. Yeah, Telluride's no joke. They're actually, I think they just had a crash not too many months ago. A guy and his fiancée, or I think they just got married, and they didn't make it out of the valley. It's very dangerous. You need to know what you're doing. He flew up the wrong direction. You know, you starting off, it's one of the highest airports in the country or the world. It's pretty high. Was it like 7,000 feet or something?
It's over that. It's close to 9.
Yeah. It's way up there. So airplane performance right off the bat is way reduced. You know, there's just not as much air for the engine to use, and or to, for the wings to produce lift. So you need to be, you need to make sure you're looking at your performance charts, make sure you can get out of there. So sketchy airport, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And it, if people want to go look at photos of it, it's just wild looking. It's basically on this mesa floating in the sky. It almost looks like what landing on an aircraft carrier would be like. And it even has these sort of ramp ups in a way, and it, for all intents and purposes, it looks like just a jump off a cliff.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a little ski jump off the end. Yeah.
Pretty wild.
It's a beautiful place. It's cool to fly into.
Yeah. Are there any other airstrips that kind of fall into that category for you, just in terms of uniqueness?
Yeah. Courchevel in France. That's a big one. That's a one-way strip. It's right next to a ski resort, and it's way up in the mountains, and it's just this little strip they stuck in the side of a mountain, basically. And that's a no go around strip. And what that means is once you're set up to land, you're landing, whether you've screwed it up and you're going to crash or not. If you try to go around, you will not make it. And so, the other one is, what the heck is the name of it now? I can't think of it. It's down in St. Bart's, down in the Caribbean. It's very short, and you've probably seen videos of it, maybe not, but you know, you come in right over this road, and there's always people standing there, and you have to duck, and you go down this hill and land. It's a short strip with a little bit of a downhill, so a lot of guys end up landing long and going into the water. That's always fun. So
yeah. So you say you've been doing it for 30 some odd years. Is it still as exciting as day one? Do you still get a kick out of these trips, or is it kind of routine at this point for you?
Oh, they're still very exciting. This is one part of, you know, aviation that never gets boring, because no matter how experienced you are, there's only so much you can do as far as planning and decision-making goes to reduce the danger. But there's one thing that you can't do anything about, and that's the maintenance of the airplane. You know, most other flights, you know, I can look at the weather and I can make a good call and I can be safe, or I can look at the amount of fuel I'll need and I can make a decision there, stuff like that. But when you're out over the ocean, if the engine quits for whatever reason, I mean, there's 1,000 things that could go wrong with the engine. And if it quits through no fault of your own, you're going swimming. And that's what makes flying over the ocean in small planes an adventure every time.
Yeah.
There's no routine flight.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's completely different stakes, obviously, but an analogy that kind of comes to mind for me that will resonate with our listeners, I think, is if you're a bike racer, and every single race, you just given a new kind of bike, and you just kind of have to, you know, you're an experienced rider, so pretty much all bikes work the same to an extent, but you got to learn on the fly, and you're not exactly sure how it's been maintained, and you got to trust the brakes and trust that the drivetrain is going to hold together and all that sort of thing. In my mind, you know, as someone that rides bikes a lot, obviously that would be crazy. Like showing up to the start of a race and you're on a different bike every time, that's a pretty wild thought. And we're on the ground. We're not even flying over oceans or trying to land at 100 miles an hour. So, let's talk about the book a little bit. So you've had all of these experiences. I'd like to hear a few stories at some point. But somewhere along the line here, you decided you wanted to write a book, completely understandably. I can't think of a much better, you know, catalog of stories that would work well for a long form book like that. What's your background in writing? Was there any intimidation factor in diving in and writing a full length book?
Oh, tons of intimidation factor. I really have zero background in writing. I mean, in high school, I did like writing short stories, and I always kind of had this back of the mind, be an author, write a book kind of thing. And I, you know, kicking around, you know, story ideas in my head for years and years. But yeah, sitting down to write a book was pretty intimidating. And the scary part is, once you're done, is giving it to the world, especially your friends, because you don't know if it's good or not. I mean, I come back and say, man, you write like a third grader. This is awful. You know, that was to me was scarier than flying a small plane over the ocean. You know, I can take the risk and I can be brave about that, but you know, the possibility that people, you know, say, yeah, that was pretty bad. This is going in the garbage. So that was kind of scary.
Did you work with a ghostwriter at all or anything, or get any sort of assistance in terms of structure and all that?
Nope. It's 100% me start to finish. I did rely on my wife, Kathy, to tell me when things sounded stupid, but a lot of times I didn't take her advice because a lot of things she wanted to do was make sure every single thing was grammatically correct. And there's a lot of parts where, nope, that's not how I talk and not how I wanted to write the book. And I went with, you know, with my gut. And I've had a lot of friends that I've told these stories to over the years who then read the book, and they can totally hear my voice say, you know, talking. And they said, it's just like we're sitting at the bonfire drinking a beer and you're telling me the story. And it was that easy to read. And that's kind of the style I was going for. And it seems to work.
Yeah. How long did it actually take to write? Like, what's that writing process like? Would you just sit down when inspiration struck and try to get in the zone and knock a bunch out? Or did you have some sort of regimented discipline style where you said, all right, every morning I'm going to wake up and work on this for an hour? What was your actual process like?
Well, I definitely didn't have any discipline involved. kind of scatterbrained that way. I did manage to bang out 99% of it in about 6 months. Got vast majority of it done. I just, my main job is running the skydiving school. So I have most winters off, and this is before I started flying corporate. So for a long time, if I wasn't ferry flying in the wintertime, I didn't have anything to do, which is great. So I used one whole winter and finished it up mostly. And then I procrastinated for another 5 or 6 years before finishing that last 1%, because that's pretty much what I do. I get about 99% of any project done, and then 1% doesn't quite make it. Just ask my wife about the bathroom upstairs that I remodeled. There's one corner yet to do. So
nice. Yeah. And speaking of your wife, I remember hearing in a different interview you did that some of these stories she wasn't familiar with. And so as she was helping you write the book, she was kind of like, oh, wow, this is news to me. do any specifics come to mind that, you know, took a little explaining away as a husband, or shed a little light on that dynamic? Because I have to assume, you know, you in some ways you were sort of living two lives. One was just this, or still are in a way, this adventure oriented, you know, gallivanting, you are your own man, you know, your life is dependent on yourself and only yourself sort of thing. The world's at your feet to an extent. And then you have, you know, your home life and all that sort of thing. What was that dynamic like as your wife was helping you write the book?
Well, yeah, there was definitely a lot of the things that happened to me in my career as a ferry pilot that I had downplayed after the fact. When I get home, say, she'll go, how was your trip? Oh, routine, you know, not much. I mean, I lost my engine in the middle of a thunderstorm and almost died, or I, you know, lost my ferry system over the Atlantic and almost died, or, you know, I lost my electric. So, you know, but aside from that, you know, it wasn't a big deal, you know. It's, when she kind of sat down to help me write the book and edit it and realized that just how close a lot of these calls really were, she had a little bit of a raised eyebrow. And there's also a part of the book where we weren't married yet, and I met a real beautiful German girl on a bus in Africa and had a nice 10-hour bus ride with her. And I thought it was interesting to put in the book, and she didn't divorce me, so nothing happened. But it's like, well, you know, it's part of the story of a young guy flying airplanes all over the world. There's a lot of stuff that happened, a lot of adventures. She was actually along for one of the adventures. I did sort of rob a bank in Spain, and she was there for that. So
yeah, let's maybe start there, because I do remember hearing mention of that. I know you don't want to give too much away in regards to stuff that's in the book potentially, but I think you do probably have to explain a little bit about how you robbed a bank and are not in prison right now, especially when it was an overseas bank. How in the world did that come about?
Well, essentially, I had my identity stolen in Spain. I delivered an airplane to a customer of ours that we had an ongoing relationship, and his air flight school manager took photocopies of my passport and opened up a bank account in my name. And then he was embezzling money from the company and depositing it into that account. And I received word from the bank, as they did a normal audit, and said, hey, you've got $50,000 in this bank account. Does that check with your records? Like, not really. I don't remember. I think I'd have known if I had $50,000 in a Spanish bank. And our friends, our customer, found out what was happening, and he thought they had maybe some organized crime ties, but he wanted to get that money back and flew me and my wife over to Spain to basically withdraw the money and pretend it was my money in the first place. So
sorry, who did it seem like might have some organized crime?
The guy that was embezzling the money.
Yeah.
So we weren't really sure exactly what was going on, you know, but we knew that there was, you know, crime involved. And I thought I was just going over to work with a lawyer and maybe try to get the money back. And when I met with those guys that first morning, they just basically shuffled me right into the bank and had me lie to the bank. And I thought, sure, we were going to be arrested on the spot. We had to go back a second time in an hour, and it was pretty dicey. And the embezzler had some connections, and he actually called Interpol on us, and I had to get smuggled out of the country in my friend's airliner. And
what in the world?
It was interesting.
And okay, so was it ever explained to you why they decided to go that route in regards to recouping their funds instead of calling the authorities?
Well, because they said, well, it's not gonna. If we go to the authorities, it'll take years to sort this out. If it's organized crimes involved, they've got the police and judges in their pockets. It'll never work. But if we just go right in right now without them having a chance to get ready, we could probably sneak the money out before they have a chance to find out. And of course, it was in my name. But when I was, you know, walked into the bank and sat down with the bank manager, and he showed me. The scary part was he showed me the bank application, and the signature was an obvious forgery. And he asked me, you know, is this your signature? And I'm like, okay, at this point, I am lying. That's not me. If I, you know, what's going to happen if they catch me? I had no idea. I just didn't want to go to prison in Spain. And so that was a dramatic moment. Finally said, yeah.
Yeah, and I have to assume all of this was taking place in Spanish, or were they speaking English at this point?
No, in Spanish. So my friend and his lawyer, they were translating to me, and I kept stalling because I was terrified. Like, what? And he's like, is it yours? And they're all like, they're all looking at me. They've got this whole room full of people looking right at me, standing over me. And I'm like, yeah?
And then why did you have to get smuggled out after the fact?
Well, once we got away with the money, the guy that the embezzler, his brother worked in the bank, and they called the authorities and said, hey, the guy that put that money in, he didn't have any right to take that money. It wasn't really his account, just some American. And they called Interpol to try to stop me from leaving the country so they could get the money before I could leave. And I guess if we had sat and tried to explain it to the authorities, they might have believed us. But it's, you know, when you're dealing with foreign countries and their police system, you know, the court system, I just wanted to get the heck out of there. So I bolted.
Yeah. Has there been any sort of fallout or aftermath with all that? Any sort of communication, whether with, you know, Spanish authorities or U.S. authorities?
No, it never... I was kind of leery of going back to Europe for a year or two because I couldn't. This is a long time ago, so there's no internet, so there's no way to check to see if you're on the most wanted list. But I never heard anything. I mean, our customer, my friend there, you know, he got the money back. I signed it all back over to him, and he had talked to the manager and confronted him with it, and they kind of sorted it out. But I never was 100% sure if he ever dropped the charges against me or whatever. But so far, every time I go to Europe, I don't get arrested. So apparently I'm all right.
Do you still ever have any sleepless nights, or did you, you know, shortly thereafter?
A little bit, yeah.
Afraid, you know, some you know, muscle from the organized Spanish mafia or whoever shows up in Wisconsin.
Well, that's what I was originally worried about. You know, it's like $50,000 is significant, and you never know if somebody's just going to show up wanting their money back. And they had my name, they had all my information, they had my address. You know, they knew exactly where I lived, and that's why I didn't really want to do it in the first place. They kind of talked me in and said, we'll fly over to Spain. We'll talk about it. You'll meet with a lawyer. We'll discuss it. That's all I thought I was going to do. And we were having coffee our original morning when we were going to meet to talk about what to do. And he goes, well, let's go. The bank's right there. We were sitting in front of the bank, essentially. Like, wait, now? I was not at all mentally prepared to go into a bank and do what I did. So,
wow. So is that, I mean, you've been in a lot of dicey situations in your life in this line of work. Is that still the scariest moment that you've had, do you think, in regards to all of your adventures, brushes with death, et cetera?
You know, it's way up there. I've had a lot of in-flight emergencies that were really, really close that I was pretty sure I wasn't going to make out of a couple of them. But you know, when I'm dealing with an in-flight emergency or a skydiving emergency or something like that, I'm too busy working the problem to be scared. You know, I'm trying to, you know, I've got a problem. I got to come up with a solution. I've got to draw upon my knowledge and skill to get out of this thing. And I'm, you know, one of my famous sayings that I tell all my students is, if you've got time to panic, you've got time to do something more productive. So that's what I always do whenever presented with a problem like that. But yeah, sitting in that bank, there was nothing for me to do but just do it, you know. And that was pretty scary.
Yeah, yeah. I remember hearing about one story that sounded, in regards to problem solving, that sounded really, really dicey during a flight, where a fuel pump went out, I think, and you had to basically suck the fuel, or pressurize the tank by blowing into the fuel tank to get more fuel to the engine. Or was it to transfer fuel? I can't remember exactly what it was, but it sounded like this nutty situation where you're at high elevation, it was cold, you were, you know, breathing gas fumes, and for hours just blowing into this this fuel tank. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, sure. That's one of the trickiest situations I've been in. I was flying a plane from Canada straight across the Atlantic to Paris. It's 2,500 miles, and normally we don't take that route because it's too far. But that particular night, we had really strong winds aloft, you know, a real great tailwind, so I could make it, pretty much cut a day off my trip. And
how strong a winds? Just for context, up that high, how strong a winds are we talking?
I think I had probably a 50 to 60 knot tailwind, which was, you know, pretty strong. Unfortunately, it was at 15,000 feet. So, and that plane I was flying didn't have oxygen. And per FAA regulations, anytime you're over 12,500 feet, you need to be on oxygen, definitely above 15,000 feet. So I wasn't exactly legal that night, but I'm over international waters, and what's anybody gonna do, you know?
Can't be worse than robbing a Spanish bank.
Yeah, right. I've got a pretty good high altitude tolerance. I work at altitude a lot, so I was okay, as long as you're not doing a lot of physical labor, you know. And the plane had ferry tanks in it, and when I went to 4 hours into the flight, I went to move the fuel from the ferry tanks out to the wing tanks so I could use it. It wasn't working. The fuel wouldn't transfer. And this particular system, we have an outside line that points into the wind basically and blows air into the ferry tank, which pressurizes it, which will push the fuel from the ferry tank out to the wing tanks where it can be used. And that had malfunctioned. You know, I disconnected the line. It wasn't working. And I was kind of screwed because I was way past the point of no return. There's no way I could turn around and fly back to Canada. And there's no way I had the enough gas left in the tank to make it to Europe, you know, even England or Ireland. I was pretty screwed. And I had to find some way to move that fuel and pressurize that tank. And the only thing I could think of was to blow in that hose. And I, you know, it just occurred to me, like, I can blow up an air mattress. Maybe I can do this. And so I started blowing into that, and it worked. But it only moved a little bit of fuel. For as hard as I could blow and cap it off with some duct tape, it just moved a little bit of fuel, and I had 180 gallons to move. So I literally had to spend 8 hours blowing into that tube nonstop. And as the ferry tank got lower and lower, as the air volume increased, and I had to pressurize it even more and more. And it was torture. Yeah. It was middle of the night. I hadn't slept the night before. I'm at 15,000 feet. There's gas fumes in the cockpit, and I'm passing out, and it's just agony. And I couldn't land in Ireland because there was fog over all the airports, and I pretty much had to keep going or crash in the ocean. You know, there was really wasn't any other option. So, you know, kind of had to gut it out. That was a big challenge.
Yeah, that's a crazy scenario. So when you're simultaneously trying to fly the plane and pressurize these tanks, what did that look like in the cockpit? Like, how much autopilot was there that you could rely on while you were trying to pressurize this tank? Or are you sort of flying with one hand, blowing into this tube in the other?
Well, the plane did have an autopilot, so that made it a lot easier. But, you know, aside from doing that, I still had to do all the normal pilot duties. You know, I still had to navigate. I still had to do fuel calculations. I still had to, you know, keep, you know, talk on the radio when it was necessary. But for a lot of it, when you're out over the middle of the ocean, you know, you're just so far beyond help, and just you're alone. You're so alone when you're 1,000 miles out at sea. It's incredible. And it's at night, and there's, you know, the radios don't work except for the one HF radio. It's kind of like a ham radio we use when we're out over the ocean, but that's pretty quiet in the middle of the night. I'm just sitting all alone in this little cockpit. It felt a lot like being in a space capsule on the way to the moon. You know, I'm literally that far beyond help, you know, because nobody can do anything for me. I mean, there's nowhere to go. There's no timeouts. There's no land to go fix the problem. It's like, keep that engine running for another 8.5 hours or die.
Yeah. In that sort of situation, do you have any sort of communication that you might relay your information your situation? Like, while that was happening, did anyone else know what was happening, or did that not, you know, were you not able to communicate how dire the circumstances were until you were, you know, close to France?
I did have a radio that, it's like a ham radio. It's called HF, high frequency radio, that I could talk to Oceanic Control. And if I hadn't come up with a solution, I would have told them about it. But, you know, and I would have given them, you know, my position of where I crashed, where to find me in the raft, hopefully. But once I was, as long as I was still in the air, there wasn't really any point in telling them anything. Because once you declare an emergency, especially when you're dealing with the Europeans, it's a nightmare. They, you know, they big investigations get started, and it's a huge hassle. And it's like, you know, if this stops working, if, you know, if I lose the engine, I can't do it anymore, I'll let them know. But the other thing is, when you're that far out at sea, they can't send anybody to come and get you. They have to send a ship. I mean, a helicopter won't go that far. They don't have seaplanes anymore. So there's not really any rush. It's not like they're going to launch a helicopter to come meet me as I crash. So
have you ever had to make an emergency landing in the water?
I have not had to ditch. Not yet. Thank yeah. God.
What was your impression of that pretty high profile commercial jet that landed in the Columbia River a few years ago? That was a wild story. Was that, you know, the pilot was hailed as a hero, obviously, rightfully so. I thought that movie was really interesting, where there was some kind of nasty, you know, behind the scenes stuff legally and all that sort of thing, as probably you'd expect. But in your estimation, that landing that he made, do most pilots have the sort of training and confidence to execute an emergency landing like that? Is that a, obviously it's not routine, because emergency landings on water are not routine, but in most cases, would most pilots been able to have execute that well, or was that an impressive feat that really garnered a lot of extra respect, do you think? Do you get what I'm asking?
yeah, exactly. Well, there's two parts. Number one, the actual physical landing on the water, most airline pilots could do, because it's just like landing on a runway. I mean, just keep the plane level, don't stall it, grease it in as much as you can. Where he became a hero in my mind is making that decision to put it down in the water, because most pilots wouldn't have made that decision, because the problem is with most pilots is they can't accept the fact that they're going to crash. You know, most pilots would have gone for one of those airports and come up short and put it down in the middle of the city and killed everybody on board and 1,000 people on the ground. Yeah. Because they can't bring themselves to realize, yep, I can't make that airport. It's not going to happen. I need to get this plane down safely. I'm going to put it right there. And he made that decision early enough that he was set up fine, and it was almost like he didn't even second guess himself. He said, how about that one? Nope, can't make that airport. Out of options, I'm going to land right there. And did a masterful job. There's a lot of pilots that die these days when they have an engine out because they stall the plane and spin it, because they can't accept the fact that they're going to crash. And that's what kills them. You know, they keep, here come the trees, and they keep pulling back. It's like, no, I don't want to crash. It's like, well, you don't have any choice, dude. The engine stopped. It's coming down. Yeah. Do you fly the plane all the way into the crash, or do you want to spin it and go straight down and die for sure? So
yeah,
he did. In my opinion, he did a great job.
And what was the name of that movie again? Can you remember off the top of your head?
Sully.
Sully. Yeah. Yeah.
Or it was like, you know, Miracle on the Hudson is what they call it. And I think it was Sully.
Oh, it was the Hudson Sully. River, not the Columbia.
Hudson River, yep. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, great movie. Everyone should go check that out. Yeah, it's, boy, the small plane thing, it's they're dicey. I mean, it blows my mind that you've just made a career out of that. I've been in a Super Cub before. I've actually flown a Super Cub, had the opportunity to execute one 180 degree turn. Obviously it was a learner's cockpit and everything, and I wasn't actually flying the plane. I just got to be the one that moved the moved the joystick. But even that, I mean, you just feel like you're in this little glider almost. It feels so fragile. I know that's sort of an extreme example. A Super Cub is a very small plane. But even that, you know, it took me 5 minutes to turn this, to execute this 180 degree turn, and the pilot that was in the cockpit with me was like, just so you know, you can do it this way. And he just, you know, flings the joystick all the way over, and we just bank super hard, and you know, I feel a G or two. I'm like, whoa, that was crazy. Didn't know that plane could do that. And they feel fragile, but capable in good weather. But I couldn't imagine being in one of those things in bad weather, or you know, switching fuel lines or pressurizing tanks or whatever it is. My grandfather had a Piper Cub and flew he and my dad over the Gulf from Houston to Belize one time when my dad was pretty young. And I guess to get across it in the Piper Cub, he had to just switch fuel tanks, like manually, like uncouple a hose. They were gliding, you know, engines off across the Gulf, switch the fuel line into the other fuel tank. And boy, that's just gives me the heebie-jeebies. But I suppose you get so good at it and a little bit desensitized in a way to the to the risk factor until you have one of your famous experiences. Do any other stories come to mind that you'd like to share? At some point, I'd like to transition here into some of the Discovery Channel show stuff, but any other stories you'd like to share that are especially memorable or exciting?
Yeah, there's so was a time I'd taken off. I was flying from Morocco to the Ivory Coast and flying down across the Sahara, across the big bulge of Africa. And that route, you always fly that at night, because down when you get by the equator, it's the intertropical convergence zone, pretty much guaranteed massive thunderstorms every afternoon. So you fly that route at night to arrive there in the morning when the weather's good. And I took off from Morocco, being chased out of there by a sandstorm. Big Haboob was rolling in, so I got out of there. And 3 hours into a 14-hour flight, I lost the alternator on the plane. The alternator generates all the electricity for the plane. And there are no airports between Morocco and Ivory Coast. Over the Sahara, there's literally nothing. And I had to fly for 8.5 hours or so by holding a flashlight. And this one, I had to fly the plane. Yeah, because the autopilot uses electricity. So all the lights went out. I'm holding the flashlight. I'm navigating. And I've got to do this all night long and try not to die. And it was that evening that I realized that whenever you're flying at night, you should always carry two flashlights. Because when the batteries on my one flashlight started going out, I had to change batteries. And I realized that if I screwed it up, like dropped part of the flashlight, I would die. Because in an airplane at night, where there's no lights at all, it's basically like flying in a coal mine. If you can't see the engine instruments, you can't control the airplane. There, you would go out of control, the airplane would spin. It's like basically going blind. And so just the simple act of changing batteries in the flashlight literally became a life or death situation. I mean, I practiced it. Batteries in the mouth, okay, here we go. Change the batteries. I mean, it's just that simple, the little thing. That whole night was another one where I didn't know where I was going to go, because, you know, no GPS, no nothing. All the instruments, all the navigation was out, and I had to find this airport at, you know, on the Ivory Coast somewhere the next morning. And if there was clouds over that coastline, I'd fly out back out over the ocean and never find land. So just another little average day in the life of a ferry pilot. Yeah.
So before GPS, how were you navigating in a situation like that? Like, forget that the alternator went out, even from a more basic standpoint, when there's no GPS and you're flying at night, how do you navigate?
Well, over land, you have, you know, radio beacons, VORs and stuff. Even Africa had some. I mean, there's some that I kind of got lost over Africa, because some of the navigation beacons were shut down because the warlord stored the gas for the generators. That's another long story. But out over the ocean, it was just like Charles Lindbergh. You know, we would get a winds aloft forecast for the ocean, basically from Canadian Weather Service. And you sit down with your plotter, and for every latitude, longitude, position, you calculate the wind drift and what should my heading be based on my compass. And then you get a great circle route plotted all the way across the Atlantic. And then as you're flying, you've got a stopwatch, and you're like, okay, I've gone for 47 minutes on this heading, and now I should go a couple more degrees to the right and another hour on that heading, and just kind of keep going till hopefully you pick up the Azores, you know, pick up the oceans or the islands.
Man, that's crazy. And it just seems like there'd be enough variation in wind speed that system like wouldn't even come close to working. That blows my mind.
Yeah, they actually had really good winds aloft forecasts. There's lots of times that I would land within just a few minutes of what I flight planned for. But there's all kinds of times where you might run into unexpected headwinds and it can throw you off by hundreds of miles. And, you know, we do have there are radio beacons on the islands that you can pick up a couple hundred miles out. So hopefully you're close enough that you're going to hit one of those. But I was flying in the same sky as a guy who's, he was using one of the new GPSs where they were just invented, and it broke, and he had nothing. And we were a group of three pilots, and it was just some young kid that happened to be flying that same day. And we told him to meet us by a particular cloud, if you can believe that. There's a huge cloud. Go over there and circle, and we'll fly over there. And he luckily saw another one of our planes and followed that guy to the islands, or he definitely would not have made it. No way where he was going.
That's crazy. That's a wild thought. I mean, we talk about using landmarks all the time, but using a sky mark, like a cloud, that's wild. That is very cool. So going back to the flashlight story real quick, when your alternator went out, were those radio signals, were you still able to get an idea of where you were based on those, or were those out of the picture as well?
Those were gone. Well, first of all, because over the Sahara, there weren't any. I knew... I had planned on not having any navigational help for 6-7 hours. I knew there was going to be nothing there, but it wouldn't have mattered if there were, because I made kind of a real critical error right after I lost my alternator. I shut off everything in the cockpit. That's what you're supposed to do. It's like, because the battery still has juice in it, so you shut all the lights off. You shut everything off that uses power. And then you save it for when you really need it, like to get the landing gear down and to pick up navigation beacons. But the last thing I did before I shut the HF radio off, which is like I said, a real powerful ham radio, is I was going to make a kind of a mayday call to tell air traffic control that they weren't going to hear from me for the rest of the night because I lost this. And when I keyed the mic, everything in the cockpit went dead, because that radio drew a huge amount of power and it sucked my battery completely dry in an instant, and they didn't hear me anyway. So that was a pretty big mistake.
Yeah. And so basically you just had to completely trust your flight plan, because for all intents and purposes, you were flying blind.
Pretty much. Yep. In the morning when the sun finally came up and I past the Sahara, now I was over jungle, I could see over the tops of the trees, I could see mist coming up over the tree line, coming over the trees, and I could tell there was zero wind on the ground. And so I dropped down to treetop level and flew down there, because I knew first thing in the morning there's no wind and I wouldn't get pushed off course by a wind. So I kind of did that for a while, and that was one way I helped me find the airport that I was going to.
And then you just saw, did it all by sight at that point. Like you eyeballed eyeballed the runway and brought it in that way. Man, that's crazy. That is crazy.
Yeah. I had to pump the landing gear down manually, because that meant landing gear and the flaps didn't work. The radios didn't work.
Oh my God.
And
how do you do that manually?
There's a little pump. Every plane with retractable landing gear has a system built in case for that emergency. And I, you got to pump it that one. Like it was like almost 100 times, to get the landing gear to come down, but you don't know if it's really locked, because there's electric lights that tell you the landing gear is down and locked, but they don't work if you don't have any power. So you just keep pumping until you think you got it and hope the landing gear doesn't collapse on landing. So.
And when you make it through something like that, where there was a system failure, are you just cursing the name of the owners of that plane, to the end of time? Do you give them a nasty phone call and say, "Hey, you might want to work on your plane"?
No, actually, I'm a sick and twisted individual. I love those things when they happen. I absolutely, when I get down, if I have an emergency and I make it, I'm jazzed. I couldn't be happier. That I go, that was awesome. Because I practice for this. I plan for it. My whole life has kind of been working toward managing emergency situations. So when I have one that then works out, I'm jazzed. When I have my parachute malfunctions and I have a cutaway and I get to the ground, I couldn't be happier. That's awesome. Cause I love that challenge. I love conquering that challenge. I know that maybe shouldn't be the attitude that I have. I don't go seek out those things. I kind of put myself in a position where they might happen, but I do everything I can to prevent them. But when I'm presented with one of these emergency situations and I'm able to conquer it with, you know, with skill and not just luck, I'm pretty happy with that. That's why I'm there. I mean, anybody can fly a plane on a beautiful sunny day. You know, it doesn't take anybody with any special skill to do that. It takes a really good pilot to come through when the chips are down. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let's talk Discovery Channel. So I'm not the only one that's been mind blown by all of your adventures. The Discovery Channel came calling, and ran two seasons of a TV series. Is that right?
Yep, two seasons of Dangerous Flights.
Yeah,
it's called.
And you were one of how many pilots that were part of this show?
We had six guys. Yeah.
And how did all of that work in regards to your relationship with flying? Did it completely change, you know, the dynamic in the cockpit? Were you still able to enjoy flying in the same way? Did it kind of tarnish your relationship with all of this a little bit, or elevate it? You know, what did it feel like to have cameras and a storyline and, you know, probably a little bit of pressure to play up drama at times, all that sort of thing?
Well, I loved it. It was a lot of fun. You know, they always had us set with another pilot, which was different than my normal ferry flying. Almost when I ferry fly, we're almost always single pilot, but they have to, for the Discovery Channel show, we put two pilots in there because you've got to have somebody to argue with, you know. Otherwise, just a guy sitting there staring at the windscreen the whole time. That's kind of boring. I learned a lot of patience on that show, because when you're getting filmed, everything takes twice as long. You know, I'm feeling like just walking across the ramp to the airplane, the cameraman will say, wait, and he's got to run up there. Okay, now, and you got to, you know, just film you walking. You learn to be an actor, because when they try to film continuously, but inevitably something will happen when the cameras aren't rolling. So then they want you to repeat that. Like if you're having a conversation with the camera, wait, that was awesome. Stop talking. You know, now say that, do that all again. Like, well, now I got to remember my conversation, which was kind of interesting. The flying end of things was really cool, because they were all real trips. None of it was scripted. They were real planes getting delivered to real customers. And aside from one instance, everything that happened on the show was true to life as it happened. Now they dramatized up things and they wanted us to be a little more interesting. Like the producers told me right off the bat, the audience has to either love you or hate you. Just don't be boring. So I immediately said, dibs on being the jerk. So if you watch the show and you think, man, that guy's kind of an ass, like, wow, it's for the show. But no, it was really a lot of fun. I got to get my daughter on one of the trips, and that was pretty cool. You got to watch us argue with each other in the cockpit, you know. That was pretty fun. You know, there, and lots of real life stuff happened. One of my scariest moments ever happened right on the show, live on TV. Flying to Narsarsuaq, that's the southern tip of Greenland, the airport in Greenland. It's one of the most dangerous airports, you know, for a couple of reasons. One reason, it's way deep in the fjord. You know, it's one of those no go around airports. You know, there are high mountains all the way around it, and it's very scary to get into. Low clouds will shut it down in a heartbeat. And the other problem is, once you're close to it and you're low on fuel, there's nowhere else to go. So if the weather gets crappy, you're really screwed. And we were flying from Iceland to there, and 90 miles out, we got called, say the airport was closed due to bad weather. And we were kind of stuck. You know, there was another airport that was maybe within range, but it was probably going to get closed down too. And I thought, sure, that one was going to be, we were going to either land on the ice cap or out in the ocean, because there aren't a lot of options. But just in the nick of time, the airport opened up again. So
I bet they loved that.
Oh yeah, they did love that. You watch me. As soon as I hear that, I throw my clipboard down. I yell at the pot, reduce the power. God damn it, son of a fucking fan. Shit.
That's funny.
So now you get to see exactly how I react in an emergency situation. I'm pissed.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, my understanding is the show ultimately got canceled because there was a tragedy that took place. Are you willing to talk about that at all?
Sure. Toward the end of the second season, one of our planes was delivering. They were flying a Grand Caravan to Kenya, delivering it to some, I think it was a safari outfit down right by Mount Kenya. And as they flew into Mount Kenya, over Mount Kenya, they knew that there was an airplane wreck up high up on the mountain, and they flew over it and took some pictures. And the cameraman, who was a real good friend of mine, he was John Driftmeyer, had filmed me all through all of season one. We literally flew around the world twice with him in the backseat. He had told the pilots to, can you please get us lower and slower so I can get better video? Because that's the cameraman's job, to tell the pilot to do something really dangerous, because that's what they always do. Can you go lower and slower, which is adding the danger? And the pilot who was flying, a good friend of mine, Pete, one of our pilots on the show, said, no, not going to do that, because this wreckage was in a place called Dead Man's Canyon. It's basically a big bowl at 11,000 feet up on the side of Mount Kenya, and they have real nasty winds and rotors, and there was a reason the plane was crashed there, because it's a dangerous spot. So we refused to do that, and they landed. And they finished filming the episode, and the pilots went home, and the cameraman and his assistant stuck around to do a safari and just kind of enjoy Africa for a while. But the inability to get a really good shot of that crashed airplane bugged him. John was a perfectionist. He's a fantastic director and cameraman, you know, but he wanted to do the best job he could. He really wanted a better shot of that wreck. So he hired a doctor in a light sport airplane, a real small airplane, to take him up there and get better pictures. And when they got up there, the doctor made some kind of mistake, and they stalled the plane and spun it in, and they were both killed, unfortunately. And that was an emotional day. He was a really good friend of mine, and we miss him.
Yeah. How frequently has that happened in your life, that you've lost acquaintances, you know, maybe not close friends, but, you know, it seems like the stakes in this are pretty doggone high.
Yeah. I've got a pretty bad track record, unfortunately. I don't like to actually make a count, but I'm up to about 17 relatively close friends that have died in airplane and skydiving accidents.
Fuck.
Yeah. It's, some of them ferry flying, some of them skydiving, some just regular airplane crashes. It's a lot higher than most people. And really trying to do my best to reduce that number. I try to educate my friends as much as I can and prevent from doing that. But it's a dangerous business.
And have you... does that give you any pause at this point in your career? Have you cut back? It sounds like you have cut back some. Are you still, you know, like you said, you never take on a job looking to thrill seek. You're taking on the job to do the job well. But, at this point in your career, you know, that sort of, adventure that you detail in the book, is that the sort of thing that you still hunger for?
I'd like to say I'm smarter in my old age, but maybe a little bit, but I still do it. I still hunger for the challenge and the adventure of it. I'm really trying to not do any more single engine over the ocean. I haven't done one in over a year now. Kind of sounds like I'm at an AA meeting. Hi, I'm Gary, a ferry pilot. It's been over a year since I've flown a single engine airplane over the ocean. but I love it. I hunger for it. I'm good at it. That's the thing. And it's, you know, when you stop doing something like that, that you're really good at, that's part of your whole life. It's, you know, it's admitting that you're getting older and things are changing. But, you know, I quit ferry flying for a number of years while my kids were growing up, because it was really dangerous. Our company lost 3 pilots. I literally got my job as a ferry pilot because they lost a pilot and they had an opening. So, God.
That's a job application for you. This job position is open because it was vacated permanently by its God. That's crazy, man.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm better all the time. I mean, the more experience I get, the safer you are. You know, like in skydiving, I have 20,000 skydives. You know, it doesn't bother me in the slightest. And like I said, if I have a malfunction, cool. It's a little extra excitement and otherwise boring afternoon of skydiving. You know, I can handle it. I've got 25 or so reserve rides, you know, so it's not really that big of a deal. I've had 3 dead stick landings in airplanes. I've had engine outs. I've had,
what's a dead stick landing? Sorry.
Dead stick was where you have to, where the engine quits and you have to land the plane with the engine completely quit. So that's happened to me 3 times and I've got it down successfully every time.
In those scenarios, were you near an airstrip or have you landed in some, you know, crazy unexpected areas?
2 I made back to an airport. 1 was actually in a Super Cub and that one I put down in a farm field.
Yeah, that's a good plane to land it off. If you got to land it off road, that's the one.
That was a great plane. That was a fun. I ferried that plane from Florida back up to Minnesota, and it had Tundra tires. I don't know if you know what those are. They're great big balloon tires.
Yeah.
And that whole trip was, there was thunderstorms and terrible weather everywhere, and I had a blast because that plane you could put down in someone's backyard. It's the next best thing to a helicopter. And when I lost that engine, it was like, oh well, I guess I'll go land in that field. And
yeah, those planes really are unreal. I mean, obviously they've got massive limitations as they're so tiny and only a couple people can fit in them. But when I was telling you earlier about the time that I got to fly in one, we landed on a little sandbar in the middle of this big lake. And I just couldn't believe, I mean, you just drop in out of the sky, hit the sand, and it felt like within 20 yards, the plane has stopped. And then, you know, you look at the end of the sandbar and there's water and just take off again in what felt like 30 yards. And those big Tundra tires, like you're talking about, just such nice balloon feel landing. It's pretty wild. Speaking of planes, are there any that come to mind as an absolute favorite or maybe one that you haven't gotten to fly yet that's kind of on your bucket list?
Well, the favorite one that I had that I flew was a Piper Aerostar. It's the fastest piston twin plane ever built. And that plane was a lot of fun because it just looks fast sitting on the ground. You know, it's long, pointy nose and sleek lines. And that was a lot of fun to fly. The one I haven't got to really fly yet is a DC-3. And I would love to fly a DC-3. That was pretty cool. I've jumped out of them a bunch of times but I've never got to actually get checked out in one. And that would be pretty neat. It's probably it's the giant version of a Super Cub. You know, it's the big, big tail dragger. You know, it's the one that they used in D-Day. All the paratroopers jumped out of that. It's an iconic plane. So love to fly in that. That'd be cool.
What's the biggest plane you've flown?
Biggest plane I flew was probably an Albatross, which was also really cool. An Albatross is a seaplane, big twin-engine seaplane. And I got to fly that to Reno for the air races one time. I was a co-pilot, but I still got to fly it. Actually, I got to solo it as the pilot went back in the plane to party with all the hot girls we had in the back of the plane. They were all partying. It's kind of funny. We heard this. I was flying along, and I'm hearing this thump, 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 thump. And I'm like, God, something wrong with the engine. I called the pilot up there and he goes, what is that? It was the bass of the stereo in the back. I go, oomph, oomph. But that's a big plane. We had 12 people in that plane.
So. Oh, wow. Yeah. And this is sort of in an impromptu way turn into a little rapid fire series here, but what about the most expensive plane that you've flown? Is there anything that comes to mind there? Or more, maybe most state of the art? I don't know if you've flown any military aircraft or anything like that, but something comes to mind that's most high dollar thing at your fingertips.
Probably the jets that I fly, the Citation 650, the Citation 7. It's that's a multi-million dollar jet. They're pretty cool. They're fast. They go close to Mach. You know, they go up to the Mach numbers, get up to 45,000 feet, and you're ripping right along. They're a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's got to be funny to bounce between a plane like that and then some of the other, you know, more modest aircraft, you know, as you take different jobs. I remember I flew private one time from Austin, Texas, where I'm from originally, to Durango, Colorado here. And we're in a Cessna something. I don't remember what it was off the top of my head. But typically, when you fly commercial Austin to Durango, you fly either to Denver first or to Dallas first. And it ends up, you know, taking at least half a day with the layover, everything, you know, typical associated with commercial. And on this private flight, we got from Austin to Durango, Colorado in, I think it was 45 minutes, maybe 50 minutes. And I was just mind blown. I was like, I cannot believe it. Felt like we just teleported and I was just ruined for the rest of my life. I was like, man, wish I had a jet. That would be sweet. Yep.
Jets are cool. I like flying jets. I like going fast.
Yeah. Well, we'll go ahead and round this out with one more question I had, which was who you look up to. I have to assume there are a decent number of young pilots that look up to your exploits and your experience level and your stories and that sort of thing. But have you had any mentors or folks that you really admire over the years? Whether pilots or not, it can be any background.
Uh-huh. My original, I guess it would be Pete Demas, my original Orient Air boss, who taught me how to ferry fly. You know, he'd had 10,000 hours of mostly ferry flying, and he'd flown just about everything all over the world. And he was definitely somebody to look up to, because he's one of those guys who's been everywhere and done everything and lived to tell about it. Took me under his wing and taught me the job, taught me the business, and I'm forever in his debt for changing my life.
Yeah, that's cool. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm so glad you reached out. This was a fun change of pace. We actually, last week we had a smoke jumper on the show, which was a little bit also out of our typical realm, but it was really fun to listen to. She's one of 9 female smoke jumpers out of the 400 smoke jumpers nationwide. She's only one of 9 females. Total incredible badass lady who obviously knows all about skydiving and dicey situations as well. But other than the two of y'all, you know, we haven't had a whole lot of aviation presence, so it's been really fun getting to learn some about it. And where can people learn more about the book that you recently released? I assume it's available on Amazon.
Yep. It's on Amazon in ebook and paperback. And if you wanted to get a signed copy, you can.
Heck yeah.
Contact me either by email at CarryMcCauley@Hotmail, or I've got a website, it's CarryMcCauley.com. So.
Awesome. Yeah, I need to get myself a copy. I probably just about every little boy grew up just completely enamored with planes, and that's carried forward to an extent. So this definitely scratched an old itch for me. But yeah, congratulations on the book. Congratulations on a really special career, and wish you the best in your forthcoming flights. And it sounds like you're working on a couple other books.
Yep. I've got a novel that's finished. It's in the editing process, and I've got another, I'm going to have a book about the Dangerous Flights show and all the stuff that happened in there. And the third aviation book will be just all the other aviation stories that aren't ferry flying related. There's a ton of them.
Yeah. Prolific. Love it. Cool, man. Well, enjoy Thanksgiving. Best of luck with the deer. You're going hunting again this evening, I take it?
Yep. I'm going to head right out.
Nice. Well, appreciate you giving us this little window, and hope your dad gets something.
All right. Yeah. Awesome.
Talk to you later. Jason. Have a good one. Bye.
Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing this show each and every week. Thank you to Zwift for being presenting partner of this show. If you didn't hear at the top of the show, we have an awesome new collaboration we're working on together. A series of group rides on Zwift brought to you by Trek Factory Racing, Zwift, and the Adventure Stash. We're all working together to create a really fun, interactive series of rides with some of the rock stars of the Trek family. What's really unique about these group rides is that new episodes of the Adventure Stash will premiere in early release during the group ride. So as an example, November 27th, we kick things off with Evie Richards of Trek Factory Racing. We recorded an episode together recently, and you'll get an exclusive first listen if you join us on that group ride. Evie Richards will be co-leading that group ride with me. So as you listen, as you pedal with us, you can ask follow-up questions of us via the Zwift Companion app. I have a feeling that those questions may come thick and fast. We'll get to as many as we can, but you, of course, can hit us with follow-up questions if we get a little overwhelmed as we're trying to type and ride at the same time. But please join us, November 27th. December 4th, we move on with the second one with Hattie Harnden, a real rising star of the mountain bike racing world. She's U21 Enduro World Series champion, cross-country hitter, elite UK cyclocross champion at only 18 years old. She reminds me a lot of Julie Furtado, actually, in that regard, just kind of killing it in every discipline. In this day and age of specialization, it's really cool to see young riders just really excelling in a whole bunch of different disciplines. So I think you'll really enjoy that conversation. Stefan Tempier will be on the show, Yolanda Neff, Ellen Noble, all kinds of riders. It'll run right through mid-February. So stay tuned as we continue to roll out those rides. You can find out more information on Zwift. You can find out more information on the Trek Race Shop website. You can get more information from my social media. So stay tuned. It's going to be really fun. A couple extra perks when you join us. You'll be able to use the Trek Super Caliber exclusively on this group ride. A replica of that bike isn't typically available when you ride in Zwift, but it will be now on those group rides. And when you complete one of these group rides with us, you'll unlock the official Adventure Stash times Zwift jersey. Actually, complete kit. I'm really happy with how it turned out. I think it looks pretty cool. It's a pretty bold design, but that's kind of what I like. And Zwift drummed up with Valet's help a really cool design. Speaking of Valet, there is a real life version of this kit too. So if you want to wear this jersey on your outdoor rides and not just in Zwift, look for that coming from Valet very soon. More information on that shortly. And if you complete one of our Zwift rides, you'll get a discount on that kit too. So stay tuned. Lots more coming. It's going to be lots of fun. When Zwift came to me with this idea, I was just absolutely thrilled. I think it's the perfect thing as we all work through this pandemic. Great way to stay engaged, get inspired, and have some fun and stay fit all at the same time. So looking forward to seeing all of y'all on these group rides soon. This episode is also brought to you by Zip. Just last week, Zip released their all-new, refreshed, and updated graphics for their stems, handlebars, and seat posts, and they look awesome. I just got them installed on my Trek Checkpoint I've been riding all year this year, and that was one of my favorite bikes to begin with. It was just beautiful to begin with, but the updated stem bar and seat post and the new Quick View integrated mount, which I'll talk about in a minute, just really took this bike to another level, and it has hands down become one of my all-time favorite bikes. The aesthetic looks so good, especially with the new Zip wheels, the updated Zip wheels that also share the same graphics, and the bike just screams speed, which is what Zip is all about. They also, like I said, it's not just a graphics refresh. They also released the new Quick View integrated mount, which is this really elegant design. You know, a lot of times when you have a bike computer on your handlebars, throw on a GoPro, maybe throw on a light, you're kind of clamping stuff all over the place. It gets pretty cluttered. This new Quick View mount can accommodate all of those things in a beautiful single package that's actually integrated and part of the faceplate of the stem. looks really cool, works really well, and is just right in line with Zip Fit, which is Zip's design ethos when they're designing anything, which is basically the idea that the rider should come first when designing bike products. I think a lot of times, you know, we hear of a really stiff handlebar or a seat post that's compliant in just the right way, or an ultra, ultra light stem. And we forget that none of those things matter if the bike doesn't fit the rider. And this QuickView integrated mount is sleek, elegant, and customizable just enough that it'll do exactly what you want it to, in terms of angle and all that sort of thing. And that carries over to all of Zip's products. Go check it out. They're all new. Graphics, updated look. It looks beautiful. Screams fast, which is on brand because Zip is all about making you faster. We will catch you next week. Thanks as always for listening.